Thank you for downloading this edition of Wartime. Remember, as always, Wartime is fully supported by contributions from listeners like you. For more information, please visit wartimepodcast.com. I hope you enjoy the program. After years of growth, the old kingdom of the Egyptian world crumbled into the hands of a few elite families scattered across the Sahara Desert. Although financially prosperous, these dark ages drove the land of Egypt into disarray and allowed for a new leader to reunify the kingdom. Known as an age of great cultural, militaristic, and societal achievement, the Middle Kingdom is considered to be a golden age of Egyptian history. But was this new system sustainable? And what forces brought it crashing down? On this episode, we discuss the Middle Kingdom of Egypt. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime. Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of Wartime. I'm your host, Brady Kreitzer. On Season 2 of the series, we're discussing the great empires of the ancient world, the forces that created and destroyed them, and the lasting legacies they leave behind that shape our modern world. As always, remember, history is best when it's shared, and you can follow me on Twitter, at Brady Kreitzer. Check for news, updates, and events on my author's website, BradyKreitzer.com, and of course your home for everything wartime on the web, wartimepodcast.com. In this episode, we'll be discussing the rise and fall of Egypt's Middle Kingdom, an age agreed by most in the field to be a golden age of Egyptian history. Although it won't be its most expansive period, and certainly not its most powerful period, the Middle Kingdom of the Egyptian world is always looked upon as an age when the Egyptians, by themselves, were a dominant superpower, and when their version of how the world should look was most implemented in their own way. But before we can talk about the Middle Kingdom, let's review a bit about Egyptian history, how we think of Egyptian history, and how Egypt found itself in a position to find the Middle Kingdom as an effective way of life. You'll recall in previous episodes of Wartime, we've discussed the fact that Egypt itself is wholly based on the flooding of the Nile River. The Nile River floods on a regular, annual basis. It replenishes their fields in a way they put their faith in, and it allows an advanced agricultural economy to flourish. It leads to a sedentary life. It leads to a way of life that works. Change is undesirable for the Egyptians, and because of that, their system begins to apply itself in a fashion yet unseen in the rest of the world. We've already talked about the fact that for the earliest part of Egyptian history, Egypt was divided between two kingdoms, an upper kingdom in the south and a lower kingdom in the north. This reversal is due to the fact that the Nile River flows untraditionally south to north, giving the people on the ground the idea that up and down are effectively reversed. But out of this world, we see a new system of power emerge, and to this point, we've described it using a word that all of us would know and all of us would understand, and that word has been Pharaoh. What is Pharaoh? Pharaoh means great house, but this is something we must be very clear on. When we use the word Pharaoh in the modern age, what we're describing is the king of Egypt, a king who is not only representative of God, but a king who believes, and the people of Egypt believe, is a god himself. We call that notion divine kingship. And it's important we clarify this. If you would go to Egypt in the Old Kingdom, or even in the Middle Kingdom, and you use the term Pharaoh, there are very few Egyptians who would understand what you're meaning. They would certainly understand what the word represents, great house, but they would not apply it to the leader itself. We use the word Pharaoh in the modern day to talk about all of the divine kings of Egypt. But they don't use the word Pharaoh for some time. In fact, it's not until the end of the Middle Kingdom and even the beginning of the New Kingdom that we'll see the term pharaoh used by the people of Egypt to represent their leader. We use it in the modern day to talk about all of the divine kings of Egypt because it adds a level of consistency to the discussion. But that is a point worth noting. The term pharaoh itself is not used by the Egyptians to represent the office until later after the Middle Kingdom. We'll continue to use it here in wartime for the sake of continuity. When we talk about pharaoh, we're talking about the divine king of Egypt. But so far this season, we've seen many divine kings of Egypt. Remember, being a god yourself is not something that's used anywhere else in the ancient world. Only the king of Egypt claims to be a living god. People elsewhere claim to be representatives of God, and certainly the pharaoh won't be the last one to do it. But what we can say is, pharaoh is the first. In our last episode, we discussed the old kingdom of the Egyptian world, and the way we talked about it was through the development of that ever so crucial edifice of the ancient world, the pyramid. Now, why do we describe an entire time period based on a pyramid itself? Well, as we talked about the evolution of the pyramid, which very much was the result of trial and error, what we see is notions of kingship, notions of power are developing as well. We use the pyramid perhaps as a microcosm for viewing the larger development of the Egyptian world. There's a few ways we can talk about these great kings of the Egyptian world in the Old Kingdom. They believe themselves to be powerful. They believe themselves to have a divine right to office. But even more than that, the people supported them. Now, how much they support them? Well, that became the issue of Episode 4 of Wartime. The Old Kingdom pharaohs showed their power and displayed their prowess through physical manifestations of wealth, most notably the building of tremendous tomb complexes to guarantee their worship in the afterlife. We talked about men like Djoser building the Step Pyramid of Saqqara. We talked about individuals like Sneferu not building one pyramid, not building two, but building three pyramids, trying to get it right just to honor his own name from the great beyond. And finally, in the Egyptian world's great masterpiece of pyramidal architecture, we talked about the king Khufu and his great pyramid, still seen to this day at Giza, which remained the tallest building on Earth until the completion of the Eiffel Tower less than 150 years ago from today. So, amazing achievements, certainly, lasting legacies, to be sure. Power was manifested physically, and the belief was building these structures would guarantee that that power would ring through the annals of history forever. Now, what's the drawback? Well, building those structures was very intensive and very expensive. It required a large amount of labor, it required a large amount of time, and I think most pressing, it required a large amount of money. Where did that money come from? Well, some of it, I suppose, could be the king's personal wealth, but on an almost 98% basis, that was tax money. Public expenditures used to create public works projects that, by the way, does not benefit the public in any way, shape, or form. So you see the issue we have in the Old Kingdom. Yes, they're the great builders of the Egyptian world. Yes, the things they build remain here in the 21st century. But at what price? What they did effectively was lose the people beneath them along the way. It's one thing to convince your people that you are a living God and you must worship me. I think if you can fool a group of individuals into that belief, you should basically get whatever you want. But it's another thing to go to the well one too many times. And in a way, that's what we can say the pharaoh does. And we'll see this not just throughout the ancient world, but throughout history. The money, the explanations were running out. And as they continue to build these pyramids, as they continue to waste blood and treasure, so to speak, they lost the Egyptian people. And that reason, compounded with a few others, mostly that reason, also with a drought that was rather unfortunately timed for the pharaohs of the Old Kingdom. We'll see the real development and fall of the Pharaonic dynasty as we know it in the Old Kingdom. And what occurs is what we describe as the first intermediary period. The Old Kingdom ends, On this episode, we're going to be discussing the Middle Kingdom. But what happens in the middle between them? Well, that's the first intermediary period. In the intermediary period, what you see are small local leaders, the very wealthy and very elite of the Old Kingdom, we can say, gain more and more power, and the pharaoh lose more and more power as well. So you have a changing of the guard in a way. But now small local autonomy reigns supreme in Egypt during this intermediary age, and it's about 130 years, a little more, of course, than a century. But when this occurs, you see Egypt split. Very quickly, you see of these small regional rulers, we'll call nomarchs. Some are more powerful than others, right? Not all nomarchs are made equal, I suppose you could say. And Egypt, although flourishing economically because of the lack of heavy taxation for these state-building projects, will be divided. It'll be rich, it'll be wealthy, it'll be prosperous, but divided nonetheless. And we could say that that sounds like a good deal for the Egyptian people, and you may want to draw your own political conclusions based on that. Lower taxation, higher economic success, until you throw this into it. The one thing that really held Egypt back, and this first intermediary period is considered a dark age of Egyptian history, is the fact that there was no clear, there was no concise, singular ruler over the region. We talked about so early on how this one figure, this divine king, we can use the term pharaoh, again, they won't use it until the new kingdom, really held this all together. The river floods, crops are good, harvests are strong, this idea. But in the intermediary period, these small regional rulers, believe it or not, were all kind of competing for that position. And they didn't really have one that they believed in. Yes, there was a pharaoh in name, there was a divine king, but he didn't have the power, he didn't have the wealth. And for that reason, its dynasty that existed at that time is considered to be relatively weak. What we see, though, are two major groups really lay claim to being that pharaoh. And when one of them wins this debate, we'll see the Middle Kingdom emerge. Economically, Egypt is sound, but they lack that one leader, and therefore they lack the confidence of the people for that 130 years to really embrace this newfound power that they have. Again, two different groups will be competing for the office of pharaoh, one in the north and one in the south. We can best describe this based on the fact that these two groups are based in two individual cities. In the south, in what we describe as Upper Egypt, you see the base of operations, the home base, if you want to use the term capital city, being that as Thebes. In the north, in Lower Egypt, you would see rule and power coming out of a city called Heracleopolis. Now, this is the dichotomy, this is the divide that occurs in Egypt during the intermediary period. They're struggling. They're wrestling for power. This intermediary period will end when the figure of Mentuhotep II, he is what we can consider to be a major warlord of the south, of the Theban Egyptian world, will approach Heracleopolis and capture the city. There's very little resistance when this happens. Again, this dichotomy in the Egyptian world, in a world so based on that singular rule of the divine king, is truly and deeply troubling to most of the Egyptian people. They look to their great past, they see the great pyramids of the past, again after 130 years perhaps losing grip on why those were there and how they were built, and they want that back. They want the divine king back in power. And when Mentuhotep takes over, when he reunifies Egypt after this intermediary period as we describe it, we'll see the Middle Kingdom begin. Now, how can we describe the Middle Kingdom? Well, I think Mentuhotep II is a good place to start, because we can see two major ruling families and two major ruling dynasties really defining the Middle Kingdom. They are the 11th dynasty and they are the 12th dynasty. And of course, we're not going to go through every member of them, but the Middle Kingdom does offer us some interesting change, which gives us a better sense of how exactly Egypt is not only developing, but also changing its perceptions of what Egypt can possibly be. We talked in the last episode about empire, about the notion that foreign goods and foreign commodities in an empire become essential to sustaining the original metropole, the original heart of the empire. And this is something that Mentuhotep, I think, really puts a premium on for a lot of different reasons. When Mentuhotep looks at his kingdom, what he sees that in Africa and in the Near East. There are a number of peoples in which trade could benefit greatly. But there's also a number of peoples that, if they really wanted to attack Egypt, if they really wanted to move into this river valley and take advantage of its regular flooding and benefit from it economically the way the Egyptians had, they could. So Mentuhotep takes the first of many major policy changes that will really define the Middle Kingdom. And that policy change is to explore these lands, clamp down on security of these borders, and most importantly for Mentuhotep, more than the area of security, is find an open and accessible way to gather these raw materials for this purpose. So this is what we're going to see. Mentuhotep will first command military commands into the south, into Nubia. And we've talked about Nubia. Nubia is today the nations of South Sudan and the northern part of Sudan. And when he does that, when he goes there, he finds the rich mineral wealth that he's looking for, most notably gold. So Mentuhotep is given credit for being the first person to really reunify a very disorganized and very divided Egypt at that point. Mentuhotep III will replace him, and for 12 years, again, consolidation is the key for him. Remember, the original Mentuhotep II came out of southern Egypt to reunify. Mentuhotep III will do so as well. He'll begin building a series of forts in the Nile River Valley, not necessarily to the west. He's not so concerned about invasions of North African peoples, but he begins to build forts to the east. Now, if you can visualize a flower, that's a pretty good representation of the Nile River. Again, flowing south to north, it's a relatively straight, relatively narrow river valley. But as you get to the top, we call this the Nile Delta, the river splits and breaks off as it enters the Mediterranean Sea. And it branches off again like a tree or like a flower. Well, when you look at that, and when you consider borders that are treacherous or borders that perhaps can be compromised, that's one we haven't really talked about much yet. We've talked about Nubia, the African region to the south. We've talked about Libya, the African regions to the west. But what is to the east? Well, eventually, if you leave the Nile Delta and continue east, you'll pass the triangular landform known as the Sinai Peninsula. And then, effectively, you're into the ancient Near East, and you're very quickly creeping into the Mesopotamian world. So this is a very critical boundary for the Egyptians. At this point that we've discussed it, there's been very little interaction between the people of the Near East and Mesopotamia and the people of Egypt. But as civilization develops and as new societies pop up, we're beginning to see that distance and that buffer is disappearing very quickly. So Mentuhotep III will take it upon himself to really sort of build defensive fortifications, we can say, or at least the beginning of defensive fortifications, in the Nile River Delta. So, not to overwhelm you with facts and figures, but we can say when we look at here the late 11th dynasty, the beginning of what we'd consider to be the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, we're beginning to see change emerge, and the change is coming from the fact that you combine all of the economic prosperity of lacking a powerful pharaoh with the security militarily of having a singular ruler as the head of state. You're beginning to see that change emerge. But we're also going to see for the first time something we haven't really touched on yet here in Season 2 of Wartime, which will be a very real and nearly perpetual threat for leadership in the ancient world and, quite frankly, into the medieval period as well. And it's this. Their entire governmental system is not based on a democratic election. This is not a republic. Their entire system is based on hereditary monarchy. And what that means is that when the king dies, he is in many ways, although the most singularly important person in the entire world as far as they are concerned, he is an interchangeable part. When the king dies, there's always a new king in waiting. It's a genetic hierarchy. It's a patrilineal system. But it's where we get the old phrase from the British world, God save the king, long live the king. The idea that when one king dies, he can be replaced. Well, that is, I suppose, a fine system, if you don't mind being entirely inefficient in the way you do things. But if you really like holding on to power for you and yours. But it's a terrible system when you consider that most of the time, when there is no notable male heir, and you will happen to be the king in charge, you have a huge target on your back. Kings often become paranoid. Kings often lose control of their faculties for this reason. And as they say, just because you're paranoid doesn't mean someone's not out to get you. So throughout the ancient world, and certainly the medieval world, if you are a king in power, and you have a young child in waiting, or you have a questionable heir in waiting, or you have no heir in waiting, you live under the constant fear and the constant threat that there are always people trying to usurp you. The target on your back is enormous. I'd like to give it this much larger introduction because it's the first time we're really talking about it. And the individual we're going to deal with next is of limited consequence based on the fact that he's just not around for long. But the person that will inherit the throne in Egypt after Mentuhotep III is, no shock, Mentuhotep IV. But here's where things get fuzzy for us again, and it gets to the issue of archaeology and history in the ancient world. There is almost nothing written about Mentuhotep IV. He has a very short reign. He disappears from history. And very quickly, he's replaced by a man who we consider to be the beginning of the 12th dynasty of Egypt, named Amenemhet I. So, what's so unique about this, and why is it a different dynasty? Well, you have to couple a few things about it together. But when you begin to do it, you see a much clearer picture emerge. Amenemhet I makes it very clear he is the beginning of a new ruling family. The fact that Mentuhotep IV disappears from the historical record altogether indicates that he was probably more likely expunged from the historical record altogether. So when you couple in the fact that it's a precarious situation, when you couple in the fact that Amenemhet I was probably a high-ranking official in Mentuhotep IV's world, it's very likely, and in fact almost accepted at this point, that Amenemhet I usurped the throne of Mentuhotep IV. After he did it, he made every effort to eliminate him from the history books, which was not impossible in that day, because the only real legacy you leave behind are the things you carve into the walls, the stories, the royal family bloodlines, and things like that. But in all likelihood, that's what happened. You had a weak monarch, you had a weak king. Again, we'll use the term pharaoh, but they necessarily wouldn't have yet. And you have a new dynasty begin. But when we talk about Amenemhet I, you're talking about one of the major figures in Egyptian history. Because he's taking over an Egyptian world that's really beginning to find a groove for itself. That's really beginning to find a role for itself in the world. It has a vision, and it has a plan to be successful. The plan, we can say, looks like this. Protect your borders, carefully registering who's coming into your kingdom, who's leaving it, where enemy armies are, and allow the economic prosperity to be successful. It's during this time we'll see Amenemhet I take some major steps to reform the region. He won't be the last person to do this, but he'll move the capital city of the Egyptian world to a new place outside of the present site of a region we call Lisht in northern Egypt. Now, why does he move it? Well, again, this gives us a little bit of insight into the ancient world and a chance to talk about something we're going to see a lot throughout our larger discussion of the ancient world. But whenever a new dynasty takes over, whenever a new king takes over, particularly again from an entirely different lineage or an entirely different family, it is not uncommon to want to erase the legacy of every other different king before you. So why does Amenemhet I move the capital city? Well, he does it for two reasons. One, he moves it out of the south and into the north, probably because he's trying to show that this is a new beginning for the Egyptian world, or at least a major change in direction in terms of policy and leadership. It's a physical display of that, and we spend a lot of time talking about physical displays of power. But he also probably does it because the southern border is becoming very, very restless. Again, the southern border of Egypt is the region of Nubia, and the Nubian region has always been a major point of contention for the Egyptian people. Sometimes they conquer Nubia, sometimes the Nubians of the various peoples that comprise them become restless and ambitious. So we're probably seeing those two things at work here. But the new capital city and a heavy dose of propaganda of why he should be in power really becomes the real hallmark of Amenemhet I's version of Egyptian leadership. He talks about the old stories and prophecies of the old kingdom. And of course, he tweaks them and tweaks himself into fitting that mold, all about legitimizing his reign. Now, we have to be careful when we talk about the ancient world, really of any culture in history, that we don't take the political element out of it. Because these are all still very practical politics of power at work. And if you are a Menemhet I, you have a lot of, I guess you can say, problems that you have to tackle to really make sure that your reign is not only viewed as legitimate amongst the people, but stays legitimate amongst the people. And a group he has to deal with, and remember, we talked about them at the beginning of the episode during the intermediary period, were these regional landed elite, the group we call the Nomarchs, that really ruled Egypt all throughout the intermediary period, these small regional kingpins or warlords, whatever you want to say, that really consolidated a lot of power. Now, you have to be careful how you deal with this, because we can't paint it that all of these landed gentry, all of these Nomarchs are against the pharaoh, because they're not. Very similar to what we think of as a political party system. Some are in favor of Amenemhat I, some are very much against him. So he's got to corral that. He's got to punish those that are against him, or at least restrain those that are against him, and yet elevate and support those who are effectively keeping him in power by not revolting against them, because that is a powerful group of people. And if you lose them, your reign is very quickly over. What Amenemhat I takes on is what we would consider to be an almost feudal system. He uses the power that he has as king. He makes them register their land. In some cases, he makes them redraw their borders to his fitting. He makes them sign agreements and contracts, swearing loyalty and fealty to him, as well as signing new agreements on how political offices would be arranged. And again, they'd be appointed by the king. Now again, he has to be careful here. He has to restrain those who could potentially hurt him, but elevate those who can help him. So these are the major hallmarks of Amenemhat I's reign. And it's all about shoring up power, again, allowing the prosperity that has emerged in Egypt to really take on a new life of its own. So what I really want to avoid as we move forward in this series is throwing too many facts and too much superfluous information at you, because I think that's a lot of the problem of history today, is that we overwhelm people with these mundane details. So we're going to skip forward a bit into the Middle Kingdom and really take a look at one of the major figures, I think, in the formation and development of the Middle Kingdom, and one of the most interesting characters, in my opinion, throughout the history of the ancient world. And he is the pharaoh Senusrit III. Now, Senusrit III has two different names, as most pharaohs do. There is his Egyptian name, Senusrit, and then there's his Greek name that later Greek historians will give them. Okay, so that's why you have that dichotomy. Remember, Khufu was also Cheops. So that's the idea we have. They have Egyptian names and more acceptable Greek names by later historians of the Greek world. Senusrit III has the Greek name Sesostris III. And in this one case, we're going to use his Greek name. Why? Well, there's no right or wrong answer to that, but I am a fan of the name Sesostris. Maybe I just like to say it. Maybe it adds some color. I don't know. But for me and my training and my world, he's always been Sesostris III. But Sesostris III has something for us as historians and archaeologists, and gives us something that most pharaohs of the Middle and Old Kingdoms don't. And it's a real look at who he was as a person. We have a lot of material left behind from Sesostris III's reign. We have busts of his face. And these carvings of his face are very fascinating to me, because they really truly show emotion. You get a sense of who he is. When an artist is making one of these sculptures, it's a still shot, it's a snapshot in time. Not just of one moment, but it's a conscious decision by the artist to portray this man in one specific way. And Sesostris III as pharaoh gives us a very unique look into who he was. He's often called a warrior pharaoh. And it's true, Sesostris III will lead a number of very pronounced military campaigns in the south. But unlike most warrior pharaohs, he's not remembered as some overblown tough guy in some way. He doesn't overinflate himself in these sculptures. But his face has a real sense of sadness to it. You can tell by looking at some of these sculptures, he's overwhelmed by the office. He understands the responsibility of the office. When he goes to war, he does so with a level of regret. because it's going to mean that Egyptian people are going to be killed, but he does have a sense of duty about it. That seems like a lot to say about these statues, but I am not the first person to say this, and when you look at the entire body of evidence we have, it's very clear about who this man was. But Sesostris III will, more than any other Middle Kingdom pharaoh, be the man who secures the borders of Egypt to a degree that fear of an outside attack is almost unheard of. Most of his construction projects, in terms of fortifications and defensive maneuvers, occur in the south on the Nubian border. Now, the Nubians, we've talked about them a lot, are a collection of many different peoples, and the people of the day that are the most troublesome for the Egyptian divine king, the most troublesome for Sesostris III, are a group of people called the Kermans. And the Kermans have a lot of things going for them that are, militarily speaking, a major thorn in the side of the Egyptians. One is they are fantastic archers. And two, they are a deeply driven warrior culture. So what you have developed amongst the Egyptians about the Kermans of the south is this idea that they are this great boogeyman. They can do things that are almost inhuman, that a normal Egyptian could never do. And this is a very human response, by the way. It's something that we see all the time in every Western culture. The foreign enemy is always given these almost untenable attributes, so that when the conquest comes, it makes the victory even more glorious. But the Kermans are said to have such dynamic sharpshooters with their bows and arrows, that they can pluck out the eye of a man from a distance of 100 yards, things like that. Things that probably aren't true, but really do add to the legend when you defeat them in that way. But Sesostris III will, and it's a fact, lead his men on the field of battle himself. He is a warrior pharaoh in that regard. And for that reason, he's held in a great high esteem at the time, and he's viewed as a major contributor to the safety overall of the Egyptian people. But in the south of Egypt, on that border of Nubia, Sesostris will oversee the construction of multiple fortifications. And these are not just forts as we know them, but these are enormous castle forts. They have multiple moats, they have multiple layers, they have crenellation around the ridges of the top of the fort. Crenellation is what you typically see like a chess piece, a rook, right? It's a square and a space and a square and a space. And crenellation is designed so archers can be successful. But what Sesostris does is builds a stone fortification that to us looks like it's right out of the medieval world. And when you factor in that those really won't emerge for another 3,000 years in Europe, perhaps, you start to really see the innovation and the desire to secure the borders of the south for Egypt. Really a powerful statement. Factor in also that these massive stone buildings are so innovative, they're really the only stone structures ever built for a military purpose. In most other places in the world, and even in Egypt for that matter, soldiers are still living in mud huts that they construct in the process of a campaign. Here you have multiple stone forts, massive stone forts, walls that are 60 to 70 feet high, with soldiers constantly on guard, constantly on watch, hundreds of soldiers protecting the southern border of Egypt. So Sesostris III is really fascinating, I think, for that reason. The warrior pharaoh, one of the multiple figures that you can find in the Egyptian world that are just so compelling. But he's certainly one that gets the attention and effect of his people for that reason. But the Middle Kingdom is changing, and it's changing for a few different reasons. Egypt itself at a core level, and we dare use this word, is becoming democratic. Well, what do we mean? The borders are secure. The threat is at a minimum. And what happens is, because of that safety, because of that security, and because of the reign of one person, inside those borders, the Egyptian flower begins to blossom. The Middle Kingdom is a time of incredible artistic achievement, incredible scientific achievement, incredible mathematical achievement. Economically, times have never been more prosperous. The pharaoh is at the helm, the people are happy, but worldviews change. You know, I say this a lot, but history really is not about the passage of events. It's not about names, dates, and places, and this is true of anywhere. History is about the change in ideas. Ideas govern everything we do. Ideas govern the way we view the world. As ideas change, as perceptions change, people change, and the Middle Kingdom is a time of great change for the Egyptians. The flourish of culture did not cause this change of ideas, but it's quite the reverse. The change of ideas caused this flourishing of a new Egyptian identity. So how did these changes emerge? Well, for one, the position of pharaoh changes. Again, we'll stress, the term pharaoh really wasn't used specifically by the Egyptians at this time. But the notion of a god king, a divine king, was. So I use that term for specificity and consistency as we move forward. But no longer can you be the pharaoh who raids the public treasury and forces his people into labor for very minimal pay to build pyramids. You can't do that anymore. At this point, the Egyptian people have grown so much in their expectations from their government and their desired new roles in their government, that to do that would be simply untenable for an Egyptian pharaoh. Now, they still do build some small pyramids, but the overwhelming majority of elites are now buried not in these grand temple pyramid complexes, but they're buried in caverns under the ground. We don't want to say they're modest tombs when you compare them to the burial tombs of Djoser and Snefru and Khufu. They're a world of difference. Again, the position, the situation's becoming more democratic. The average Egyptian is not claiming to have a larger effect on his government, but certainly claiming and asking for his government to have more room for him to succeed. Fascinating times in Egypt. Even the position of Pharaoh himself is changing. Again, in the Old Kingdom, the Pharaoh was unquestioned. The Pharaoh was the be-all and end-all of decisions. Policy was his. Decisions belonged to him. No one questioned it. He really had free reign. But now in the Middle Kingdom, the position of Pharaoh is entirely different, because the Pharaoh is now expected to uphold a certain standard in the Egyptian people. He should be everything the ideal Egyptian aspires to. He should be virtuous. He should be truthful. The Egyptians called this value system Ma'at, which really means truth, virtue, power, all of those things, right? Living that good life. Well, the pharaoh is expected to be representative of that. The pharaoh is not expected to make any decision he wants, mostly for his own egotistical benefit. Now he's expected to make the best decisions possible for the Egyptian people at the time. So the Middle Kingdom is really changing things. And again, we can even look at the cultural aspects of the Egyptian world to see how far this change has come. Remember, in the Old Kingdom, the afterlife was a glorious place. But it was only a glorious place for the super elite of the Egyptian world. If you died as an average common Egyptian man or woman, you really had nothing to look forward to in the afterlife. Heaven was for the divine. Heaven was for the kings. Well, that's changed by the time we get to the Middle Kingdom. If anything was democratized, if anything was given to the hands of the people, it was the afterlife. Because by the time you get to the Middle Kingdom, the afterlife is now for everyone. Heaven is for everyone. That great paradise doesn't just belong to the very wealthy, but also everyone, including down to the very poor. We cannot stress enough how big of a change that really is, and how indicative that is of a much bigger system of change at work. So how can we describe the Middle Kingdom in a nutshell? The Middle Kingdom is viewed by the Egyptians later on as a golden age, because this isn't certainly as big as the Egyptian Empire will ever be. But some will say, in terms of how it operated and what life was like, it's as good as it ever was. Again, it's that golden age. But there are some drawbacks to that. There are some real fears to that, which I think have to be discussed. And one is that you can, at times, when times are doing very well, you can become susceptible. You can become careless. You can become weak. That's exactly what we see happen. As these good times continue to roll, we will see later pharaohs, again, start to maybe spend a little more than they should be, but also lose some of the virtues and lose sight of some of the issues they're facing down later. One of these pharaohs is Amenemhat III. Amenemhat III will begin a number of building projects, some public works project to benefit the individual people of Egypt, but also some projects that maybe we can consider his pet projects. But to do this, he opens borders, and he allows groups of outsiders, particularly from the ancient Near East, to the north, to flow into his kingdom. He allows these people to come in because they offer a ready and steady supply of workmen for his projects. But what you start to see very quickly is that more and more and more of these outsiders move into Egypt. And very quickly they gain a footing, and they gain power to a degree in the Egyptian world. This is when we'll see the end of the Middle Kingdom really emerge. Because a lot of the people they're letting in are merely extensions of other groups farther to the north. And these are groups that are warlike, and these are groups that are expansionist. And while those early migrants aren't necessarily warlike and expansionist, the fact that they're there will allow those from their original homeland to view them as an opportunity. They know that if they invade, that pre-existing population is probably more likely to side with them, in the case of an uprising, than to side with the Egyptians. And that's what we begin to see. In about the year 1700 BCE, you see a major catastrophe, and some will say the first major catastrophe, befall the Egyptian world. Because a group of outsiders will invade Egypt, take over the lands, usurp the power of the pharaoh, and put themselves in charge. These people are known by the Greek name as the Hyksos. We know in Egyptian, the Egyptians would have called them the Hekau-Hasu, which basically means rulers from a foreign land. So the Hyksos aren't necessarily their own ethnic group, but they're very likely a group of foreigners from places in the Near East that rolled into Egypt using the power base they already have in place from years of immigration and took over Egypt. So much so that the devastation is so catastrophic that the Middle Kingdom ends then and there. So it's very hard for us to put our finger on when the Old Kingdom ends necessarily, when the Middle Kingdom begins. These sort of things can be blurry at times. Again, history is not about straight lines. It's about blurred lines. It's about not black and white, but gray. But here's an example, the end of the Middle Kingdom, that we really see that happen. The invasion of these outsiders, the arrival of these outsiders, will signal the end of the Middle Kingdom. Whatever the Egyptians had at that point, whatever the Egyptians had built in the Middle Kingdom, came crashing down when these groups of outsiders moved into their territories and took over Egypt. It's the first time Egypt will be conquered by an outside force. Now, there is some debate about the Hyksos. Was there a massive invasion, or was there not? I tend to believe that there wasn't. I think that the immigration quotas had been so overwhelmed by these outsiders that very quickly these immigrants basically had enough of a hold in the Egyptian world that they could usurp power on their own. I don't think there was a massive armed invasion. I don't think that fits the MO of these people. But there's no doubt that the Hyksos, these foreigners, so to speak, as the Egyptian called them, came in from an outside land and established themselves in control. The Egyptians had become careless. For so much of the Middle Kingdom was defined by border security, was defined by establishing good relationships with the peoples around them, or, if necessary, crushing those in opposition. It's a fitting end to such an interesting time period. The question we're posed with now, though, as we look to the future, and this will be the discussion of our next episode of Wartime, is that the Egyptians are clearly suppressed. The Egyptians are clearly on the outside looking in. Can the Egyptians rebound from this catastrophe of the Hyksos invasion? And how can they recover if they do? In the next episode, we'll be discussing the New Kingdom. Thank you for joining us. I'm Brady Kreitzer, and this is Wartime.